are listening to Radio Albion. And welcome to tonight's stream. I hope you're all well. Hope you're looking forward to all the latest news. And the first thing I want to say is, we're live on Rumble and Odyssey. Please share the links. But the next thing I want to talk about is why we're doing this stream. Over the past couple of shows I've done, I've generally been dealing with different things. There are a lot of big issues that we dealt with on the Nationalist A team. There were, on Wednesday, the show was all about Sarah Dye. It was all about what she's been doing with her life, how she's moved forward ever since her doxing and being thrown out of the farmer's market. And we ended up discussing quite a lot of white pill things. It was a really good show. Not a usual PWR, a pretty extraordinary one, actually, because it was all about the person who was on, not really about wider political issues, but what she's been doing and the way that nationalist communities in America are orientating themselves around family life, homeschooling, local businesses. It was a really good show and a bit of a white pill. A lot of people accuse me of sticking to things that are quite negative. And obviously, you know what I mean by quite negative. What I mean is truthful. And, you know, after a while, it can become pretty oppressive just listening to dark, hard truths all the time. So it's one of those things where it's nice to do a stream with someone who has solutions and is doing things in the real world and really is a breath of fresh air. So check out that PWR. But that's why we're doing tonight's stream, because there's a number of news articles I haven't been able to cover properly, and I want to cover them tonight, including a couple of breaking news stories, one about Thetford, one about the black rapist and murderer Simon Levy. I'll probably be doing a Substack about that. And also, I want to cover a few other bits and pieces and do a Q&A as well. Now, the first thing I want to bring up before we get into the stream proper is the issue of tomorrow. Tomorrow, we're in Tamworth. We're meeting at 1 p.m. at St. Edith's Square. We are doing a White Lives Matter Henry Novak demonstration to coincide with the weekend of Indigenous Peoples Day. It's important we attend these things, it's important we do these things, and it's important that we say white lives matter. No one else is going to say it. We started it, we're going to continue it. It'll hopefully be a big day tomorrow, but it'll only be a big day if you turn out. Now, usually these streams get seen anywhere between sort of about 5 and 20,000 times, and if you're one of the people watching them and you live within driving distance, or you can jump on the train, or even if you live in Tamworth itself, come and see us, come and help us, come and join us. I'll be there, Laura will be there, Sam will be there, there'll be lots of good people there. Please come down, please say hello, introduce yourselves. Afterwards we'll all go for a drink together, so plenty of time to do a little bit of socializing after the event. Obviously, all of our code of conduct applies. Don't turn up drunk. Don't bring any banned substances. Stay within the law. Act in a peaceful and friendly manner. And only bring home nation flags. If you're bringing flags, we have a strict no foreign flag policy. So don't be turning up with some Star of David or some foreign flag. They're the rules. So if you are there tomorrow, please turn up and stick to the rules. Now, secondly, I want to go into something quite briefly before we enter tonight's main stream. And actually, before we talk about this, because we've had a $10 super chat actually about this, I might as well get this out of the way at the beginning. But I've also got a new article out on my Substack today. Now, the Substack link is pinned in the chat. Please do check out my Substack. It's free to subscribe to me over there. I'm one of the few content creators who has a policy of producing articles that are 100% free to read. There are no paywalls. Nothing gets blocked away, nothing gets hidden, I don't charge you to read the articles, and I allow people to copy the articles and put them out there for a wider audience. Recently, somebody copied one of my articles, which is titled Cambridge's Black Time Travelling Professor and His Many Superhuman Feats. That was placed on Facebook by a good friend of mine. That got seen nearly 100,000 times there, and it's also been republished by the UNCE Review. It's also been republished by Notice and News and by Countercurrents. I think it's the first article I've had published on Countercurrents. So thank you to Ron Unce, thank you to Notice and News, and thank you to Greg Johnson for publishing that. And I have a new article up on my Substack today. It's called Beheaded on a British High Street, The Murder of Lee Rigby. It's actually a more shocking case than I remember. I remember the brutality of the killing. I remember the killers giving statements to the police afterwards. But something I'd completely forgot was that the killers were known to the British security services. And one of the two killers has actually travelled to Kenya, attempted to cross the border into Somalia to join a terror group, came back, wasn't arrested, was allowed to continue his business. The security services actually tried to recruit him as a snitch. He refused. And he went on to commit one of the most brutal and gruesome murders to ever be committed in modern British history. Absolutely shocking. So go and check that out. Again, it's free to read. You can check it out. It's free to read. There's no paywall there. So lots of things for you to check out. And obviously I've had a busy week, but one of the things that I was very busy with yesterday, and we've got a $10 super chat to open the show from Horatio Hornblow. He says, Mark, do you have any final thoughts on how your debate went with Bob last night? And yeah, I did a debate last night on YouTube between the differences on Christian nationalism and ethno-nationalism. Now, the guy I was debating with, he's called Speaker's Corner Bob, or Bob from Speaker's Corner. I've heard people call him both of those things, but he probably has an official name, but we'll just call him Bob from now on. And Bob was proposing a form of nationalism which was based around what he called a covenant. And he claimed his people were anyone that believed in, obviously, his particular brand of Christianity, whereas I was arguing for ethno-nationalism. Now, I'll say this. I found his opening statement very weak. I thought my opening statement was very well crafted. Let's put it like that. I worked hard on that to get it right. I thought that he was defeated on opening statements. And moments after the opening statement, when he said he would rather his daughter marry a Congolese man who was a Christian than a white Englishman who happened to be a pagan, it really told you what the tone of the debate was going to be. He largely denied things such as genetic inheritance, IQ. He sort of brushed aside European pre-Christian achievements. I was very reasonable, I thought, in the sense that I did talk about church life in England. I talked about the church being a strong uniting force for English villages and English communities and the importance of the church. But I did balance that with talking about how universalists such as him have driven people away from the church. I will say this, though. I did think he was a genuine guy. I thought he was a bit of a buffoon. And I don't mean that nastily. I just mean that as a... That's just how he came over a little bit buffoonish. But I don't bear him any ill will, and I think he genuinely believes in what he's saying, and I also don't think he's a con man. And that might be an odd thing to say, but I don't put him in the same category as your likes of Ricky Doolan. I don't believe Bob's involved in, you know, any faith healing or you know, flying people out to Africa or cryptocurrency. I won't call them scams, but cryptocurrency deals. I don't think he's involved in anything like that. I think he is genuine to his word. And he was, although he said he did lie about me on a number of occasions. He said that I believe in abortion, which I don't. He kept forgetting what I'd said. He mischaracterized me on a number of occasions. But I don't think he's a bad guy. I think he's genuine. And although I disagree with him in every, in well, not in every way, probably, possibly, but in the vast majority of things that we argued about. I also thought he framed things disingenuously, like when he tried to claim that the Ethiopians who created the Ethiopian churches, which are obviously magnificent, were sort of modern day black Ethiopians. That simply isn't true. You only had to Google the king that he referenced to see it was another case of sub-Saharan Africans attempting to claim something that isn't theirs, much in the same way that the We Was Kings Brigade claimed the pyramids as their own when they had nothing to do with the building of the pyramids, and the pyramids were built by Mediterraneans who were obviously white, obviously Caucasian people who had likely moved from places like southern, the southern Mediterranean European states over the Mediterranean to Egypt and taken root there. But that's clear. We know that. And he said he did do some of that. But genuinely, I don't think he's a bad guy. I don't think he's an evil guy. I don't think he's malevolent. I just don't think he understands the arguments. As such, I thought I did pretty well. However, if I had one critique of my performance, it would be that I did allow Bob to speak far more than I spoke. And when the other side speaks more than you're speaking, you tend to be making more rebuttals than you do affirmatives. I made a lot of affirmatives in my opening statement, but because of the way the debate was structured and because he often spoke for sort of 4 or 5 minutes, and I kept strictly, because I had a little timer on my desk, to 3 minutes, it did allow Bob to sort of make a lot more affirmatives, which I ended up rebutting. And he did say some very silly things like, London isn't the place it was because there's too many people living there. Kind of a silly thing to say when, yes, there are too many people living in London, but you would say the overriding change is the fact that those people are no longer white British. So it was interesting. I enjoyed it. I thought it was quite an easy win. I thought I provided the audience with a lot of laughs. I've read all the comments today. There's only two people who didn't like me. One person was like, they've lost total respect for me. I'm not sure how you lose total respect for me there. One person was a bit annoyed that I made the jokey comment of calling him a cuck. Some people think that lowers the tone of the debate, but I like to have a bit of fun. These aren't sort of Oxford Union debates. I like to have a bit of fun. I wasn't saying it as sort of a blood libel to him. I wasn't asking him to, get his pistol out and duel with me to the death over it. It wasn't said as a thing. He did, however, call me sort of a racist, Nazi, anti-Semite and all that, which he was probably a lot more serious about than I was when I jokingly called him a cuck. And one thing about Bob, I probably would say, without maligning him, he probably is a little bit autistic and didn't sort of get some of my humour. But I hope everyone enjoyed it. I hope everyone enjoyed it. I do these things because I like to get our points out. I thought it was an easy win. And as I said, if anything wasn't 100% correct for me, it was probably because I spent more time kind of... If you were to analyse it like a fight, I felt it was a little bit like the end of The Matrix, where Neo is sort of fighting the agent, and the agent's sort of throwing everything at him he can, and Neo's just sort of effortlessly batting it away before sort of knocking him back without thinking. And I kind of felt that was it. I was sort of effortlessly just batting things away. But I wasn't going all out myself. I didn't have to go... sort of another analogy, I didn't have to go sort of Super Saiyan to beat him. I didn't have to pull up Google and start getting facts and figures. It was a very sort of straightforward, basically meat and potato debate for me. But I hope you all enjoyed it. I hope you shared it, and I hope it provided you with a little bit of entertainment. And maybe if you didn't know all the points I made, well, I hope you got something out of it there anyway. So that's that. So we've got all the things that we're doing. We've got the debate yesterday, we've got the demo tomorrow, and we've got my Substack. So it's been a very busy week. I would say very few people are as busy as me in nationalism. Also, obviously did PWR, did Patrick Slattery, I've done David Duke on Thursday, and I've got a stream on Sunday, which either me or Laura or me or Sam will do, in order to break down what went on on Saturday, i.e. tomorrow at the demo. Anyway, there's a lot of things to talk about. And tonight's going to be a night of sort of black pills and white pills. White pills and black pills. So a bit of everything, I think, tonight. And we're going to start with the issue of Thetford. And Thetford's interesting because Thetford is one of these small historic market towns. And the sort of people who live there are decent, sort of well-to-do people. These aren't, you know, you're not talking about, I'm not besmirching these people, but we're not talking about Belfast here or Glasgow. Now, in places like Belfast and Glasgow, and I'm not besmirching the people who live there, those cities are known for sectarian violence. They're known for young men arming themselves, doing battle in the street, and regularly being involved in pitched battles. You know, you see this Rangers and Celtic games, you see this between Catholics and Protestants, or you have done in the past in Belfast. There's a different mentality in those kind of cities. But for a place like Thetford to erupt in the kind of violence we've seen over the last couple of nights tells you something. It tells you that normal people in normal places who have never previously viewed violent resistance as an option are now getting involved in violent resistance, and they are willing to go out there and take on the police. And that's very interesting because it tells you something has fundamentally changed. And what's fundamentally changed is something has snapped in a large number of people. Now, that's the white pill. The other white pill is it's a growing number of people. But unfortunately, the black pill is the numbers that we're seeing and the radicalization we're seeing is still statistically insignificant when it comes to the ballot box. And that's going to disappoint people. So what we're going to do tonight really is have sort of the tale of two areas. Two happenings. We're going to talk a little bit about Thetford, but then we're going to go through the Manchester mayoral election results, and they're sort of contradictory, but we're going to try and balance why you're seeing these two very different responses. So what I'm going to do first is pull up a share screen so we can have a look at what's going on in Thetford. Here we go. And I'll make myself a little smaller, so I'm not in the way. Do you want to watch the video? Should we watch the video? Should we see if it works? I should really have got my headset.
University? At your age? Do be serious. They're all going to laugh at you, dear.
The market town of Thetford has become the centre of violence and protests after residents stormed houses said to be used by asylum seekers. Police had to escort the occupants away from the crowds, who were heard shouting, "Get out," and screaming swear words at them. Tensions have long been rising in the area, with protests at a nearby former military barracks, which has been earmarked to take over 1,000 male migrants.
So there you have it. You're actually seeing the kind of behaviour you've seen in Belfast. You've seen normal people rise up and get these people out. They're sick of it. They don't want it. They've had enough. They're not letting them move in. And as the media are admitting, over 1,000 male migrants, they don't want it. So we'll read what the Daily Mail has to say. A market town has been engulfed by violence and disorder on two nights this week after angry residents stormed houses rumoured to be used by asylum seekers. Frustration, it's not rumoured, they know who they are. Frustration exploded into fury at three properties on Tuesday in Thetford, Norfolk, following weeks of protests at a nearby former military barracks, which has already been earmarked to take, and this is the media's words, not mine, 1,250 male migrants. It continued last night when two officers needed hospital treatment, one who was hit by a rock and another who was seriously bitten during a protest. I'm not sure who bit him. Was this a dog or a human? Three arrests have been made. The government spokesman said concerns of communities are central to our immigration reforms. Yeah, as if. The chaos on the first night saw five men having to be escorted by police from a property on St John's Way, prompting the furious protesters to brand the officers traitors, which they are. One local claimed that the landlord had told them to expect new tenants, but didn't mention there would be asylum seekers. The occupant of the house on nearby Elm Road is then understood to be forced out of his home before his phone was stolen. The disorder next spilled over into a residence in Bracken Road, which had its windows and doors smashed in. Now, in a sleepy little place like this, you don't expect this kind of activity. But this is what you're seeing. People just don't want them. People are sick of it. Up to 100 people became involved in the violence, with video capturing one man shouting, "They don't want the white man anymore. They want us all gone. They want to swap us. It's predicted by 2050 that the effing white man's going to be a minority." Officers attended another residential property in Clover Way last night after a large group of people gathered there at about 9 p.m. and tried to gain access. As they intervened, a member of the group became physically aggressive towards them, with a male officer struck by a rock and a female officer seriously bitten, breaking the skin. A third officer was spat at. Assistant Chief Traitor Julie Dean, who is overseeing the police response, said, "We will always facilitate the support and right to peaceful protest, and we recognise that people hold strong views and feelings about this issue. However, no matter how strongly these views are held, there is no place for violence, intimidation or criminal behaviour. We will not stand by and allow violence to take place, whether that is directed towards members of the public, local residents or police officers carrying out their duties. Where criminal offences are committed, we will take robust action." So what you're seeing here, and this just goes into more detail, there's not really much reason for me to read this. It's kind of like these articles are written by AI, because they just keep repeating, repeating this. Oh, well, let's have a look at this. The Labour MP actually says something. I bet this guy's a real POS. Labour MP, Jerry Turmey, condemned the mob rule and vigilantism. The Labour MP, who was chased by about 30 people after a Thetford Town Council meeting over plans for RAF Barnum, said, "I utterly condemn this behaviour, and I know many Thetford residents share my disgust and concern. Whatever our individual views on immigration, mob rule and vigilantism is not acceptable. Following these incidents, many local residents from diverse backgrounds have been in touch with my office, sharing their fears for safety. To be British is to respect the dignity of every individual, regardless of their background, race or religion." Yeah, whatever, mate. Another disgusting traitor. And it goes on here to say, "Thetford is just 3 miles from RAF Barnum, over the border in Suffolk, one of three sites being considered to house a total of 3,750 asylum seekers alongside former Ministry of Defence bases in Bicester in Oxfordshire and RAF Linton-on-Ouse in North Yorkshire. The government is also looking to extend the use of existing military sites in Crowborough, East Sussex until 2030 and Weatherfield, Essex until at least 2027. Locals in Barnum, Sussex have warned, they will be overwhelmed if the plans in their area are approved. The village is home to 580 people and has a church and no shop or pub." You know what's going to happen to that lovely old church, don't you? I mean, it's a lengthy article, but I'm going to say this. Fundamentally, what we're actually seeing here is quite unprecedented. And it's quite unprecedented because the sort of area this is going on in is the kind of area that historically nothing like this would have ever taken place. And one thing that seems to be happening is these migrant centres are truly radicalising normal people. And it's interesting. And I would say what's going on is a situation where we are seeing a rapid radicalisation of a growing, sizable minority of people. So what we're reaching here is almost sort of a critical mass where around 10% of the population, 10% of the white population, maybe more actually, maybe just a little bit more, maybe 12%, in some areas slightly more, are really waking up, becoming radicalised, but most importantly becoming racinated. And that's the point. They are understanding for the first time the issue of race, and you're starting to see people put two and two together and get four. This isn't about culture It's not about religion. It's about white people being replaced. They're not talking about value sets. They're not talking about assimilation. They're not talking about working with people to ensure that everyone becomes one and we learn to put aside our differences. They're talking about replacement. And for that kind of radical mindset to be part of a sizable, roughly 10% and growing minority is a very, very good thing. And once people have understood this, hopefully it'll be with them for life. Hopefully it will be with them. And also, things are only going to get worse before they get any better. So what you're going to see is an awful lot of people coming to these conclusions. But once they've come to the conclusions, I believe they will continue to notice things and they'll become more awake to other issues that we discuss. I think this is a really positive thing. But if you remember how Black Lives Matter, left-wing activists are treated when they attack the police, damage property, etc., etc., we need to look how these people are going to be treated. And this is very important. This is from the Reading Chronicle. Full force of the law to be imposed after officers hurt in Thetford disorder. Those involved in anti-immigration disorder in Thetford, where people attempted to storm homes linked to asylum seekers and police officers assaulted, will face the full force of the law. And this article, I'm not going to read it all because it's very similar to the last one. This goes into great detail about how people should be worried. You know, they are following these people up. They're going to make sure these people, go to jail. They're going to basically hold people fully to account, which is not what happens when the left protest. And I think this is something else that's very important to note about all of this. We obviously could go all night on the threat that asylum seekers pose to British people. We could go all night into the fact they're not really asylum seekers. We could go all night into the changing mentality of British people. But I think one thing that we must touch on is the two-tier justice here. If this was people on the left, let's say a group of nationalists bought up houses somewhere and the left turned up and started smashing windows, it would be a case of, look, the community is upset, they have legitimate grievances. There would be a very, very different narrative coming from the state. But the state now, you can see, is utterly desperate to come down on these people like a ton of bricks, because they want to break people. They want to ensure people who are becoming racinated do not make the full transformation into fully awake racial nationalists that understand issues such as race, IQ, white genocide, and later down the line start talking about the Epstein class and the people who are behind our replacement and what the ultimate goal is for these people and what our ultimate future will look like if these people get their way. So I think that is something that's very important. We are seeing this waking up of a sizable minority which is growing. It's a real radical process. And remember, this is all part of the white pill. Generally speaking, people who change history are small in number. They are small, radical minorities that often hold viewpoints which are seen at the time as more extreme than the majority of normal people who stay out of these civilizationally defining events or historically defining events. Anyway, let's have a look now at Manchester, because this kind of flies in the face of this, and I've got an interesting conclusion on this. So here's what we saw from Manchester, and we didn't do this on stream, did we? But here's what we saw in Manchester. Now, obviously, the Manchester results came in very late. And what you can see here with the Manchester results, and this is the first round result, is Labour took 47.1%. they took more than double. They nearly took an actual majority, but they took more than double Reform, who were in second place. Interestingly, the Greens came in third with 12.2%. Restore did better than expected. Well, Reform did better than expected, and Restore did better than expected. They got 8.7%. That was obviously boosted quite significantly by the fact they had a local celebrity candidate, Marlon West, whose daughter was horrifically abused by grooming gangs. And, you know, she obviously went through a living hell at their hands, and he's become an author, he's talked about this, he's become a local celebrity. They will have benefited from that, which maybe have boosted their vote by a percentage point or two, but they did better than expected. The Conservatives still took 7.7%. The Lib Dems did really badly for them. They took 2.8%. But what you've noticed here is nigh on half of the people in the whole of Greater Manchester, which is the third largest area in the whole of England, the biggest being Greater London, the second biggest being the West Midland mayoralty, the third being the Greater Manchester mayoralty. Now, when this result finally came in, which was, as you can see, 3 minutes to midnight, we ended the stream at about, I think it was about 9:30-ish, because we'd gone for 2.5 hours. We certainly wouldn't have gone on till midnight anyway. We already knew who the front runners were, Labour and Reform. But what this election tells you is, even though we have these massive problems, which we do, nearly half of the people in the third largest electoral district in England are still voting Labour. And when you add the Labour vote, the Green vote, and the Lib Dem vote, you have over 60% of the vote. So over 60% of the vote went to pro-immigration, progressive, openly anti-white parties. Now, I say, I've not included the Conservatives in that. We know they're anti-white, we know they're progressive, we know they're pro-migration. The reason I didn't include them is because they're not openly pro-migration. There are still idiots out there who think they're good people. But what I'm basically trying to get at here, and this is important, what I'm getting at here is, although we are seeing this immense white pill, where a sizable minority of people are becoming racially aware and are willing to take part in activism and activities against mass immigration, unfortunately, that is still not reflected positively at the ballot box. And what we're seeing, because of demographic change and because there are an awful lot of white people who are brainwashed, anti-white, progressive, liberal, pro-multiculturalism, we are seeing in these large elections these horrible outcomes. And really, this dovetails with what I've been trying to say to people for a long time. I've always said we need community, we need activism, we need advocacy, and we need structures that promote those three pillars. We need structures like Patriotic Alternative that help political prisoners, that spread the word, that help people with protests, that build communities, that hold events, that are willing to educate people and provide them with leaflets when they're campaigning against these asylum seekers being housed in their community. But unfortunately, despite this sizable minority of people who are now becoming racinated, it's a fantastic thing they are. I mean, as I said, we're talking around 10%, which is more than we've ever seen in post-war Britain. So this is amazing. Unfortunately, that 10% isn't enough to see change at the ballot box. And when you're looking at these major elections, unfortunately, when you take the white traitor vote, the white liberal vote, and you add it to the ethnic minority vote, we are now seeing this undeniable and repeated outcome where the progressive nakedly pro-immigration candidates are taking the majority of the vote. And this is a problem if you're going after the ballot box. And I think the role for ethno-nationalists is to go to communities like Thetford, to go to places like Linton on Ouse, like we've done before, to go to places like RAF Scampton, like we've done before, ingratiate ourselves with these people, show them how to do things in a more measured, lawful and sustainable way, help them understand why this is happening to them, and try to build a network of nationalists across the country that can work together in active protests to block these large former military bases turning into migrant centres. We have to have eruptions of these protests regularly, but we have to get involved with these communities, because as funny as it, as some people might think that, you know, somebody got bitten on the leg by somebody or whatever, it will lead to arrests, and we need people on the ground there to help these people channel their frustrations in a more productive way. So I think there's white pills and I think there's black pills. And I think fundamentally the white pill is one that I was expecting, because that's why we organise the way we do. The black pill is that, unfortunately, due to the racial split in the country of it being 70% white British, 30%, you know, some form of ethnic minority, it makes it very difficult. And the bigger the electoral district, the harder it becomes. When you have a small all-white area, you still can win. But once you get these bigger places like Greater London, Greater Manchester, you know, the West Midlands mayoralty, it's almost impossible now because of these forced demographic changes. But obviously, if anyone's got any questions, I'll answer them at the end. And because it's a serious stream, we might do some free questions and answers, depending on how people feel. You know, obviously, if people want to submit questions via paid super chats, I really like that. You know, I'm not going to lie. I'm very, very grateful when people do that, because that helps me to keep doing what I'm doing. But if people would like to ask questions of a serious nature or point out something I may have missed, I'll happily answer that later, you know, at the end, if we have time. Now, the second story I want to cover. This is a really harrowing story, and I've chosen the sort of Daily Mail article to read. And it's the story of a black serial sex offender called Simon Levy, or Simon Levy. Now, I might write a Substack about this for Tuesday and go into great detail about this, because this is one of the greatest examples of anti-white two-tier justice we've ever seen. This sex offender had raped and molested multiple women. He was known to the police, he'd been arrested, but rather than being remanded in custody, the police granted him bail. The justice system granted him bail, and he was back out on the streets. And whilst he was on the streets, he murdered two women and almost killed a third. So let's look at this article. And as I said, I think this is what I'm going to do, an article. Would people like me to do an article on this on Substack? Because if they would, I'd be more than happy to. It's the kind of thing that I would write about. But anyway, let's have a look at this. There is the man himself, and there are the two women. Serial tube sex attacker Simon Levy is found guilty of murdering two women and almost killing a third while on police bail. A serial tube sex attacker has been found guilty of murdering two women and almost killing a third while on police bail. Simon Levy, 40, suffocated Carmenza Valencia Trujillo, 53, in March 2025 before using the same method to kill Cheryl Wilkins, 39, 5 months later. He has also been found guilty of violently raping another woman in January of last year, whom he left for dead. Detectives now believe Levy may have claimed scores of victims while he was on bail, carrying out daily attacks for years, escalating from groping women on the London Underground to rape, suffocation, and eventually murder. Now, as Levy faces the rest of his life behind bars after being convicted of murder and rape, it can be revealed our police, prosecutors, and probation services missed a monster in their midst. They didn't miss him. They let him go, didn't they, because he was black. That's the punchline. In an appalling betrayal of victims, despite him having a shocking record for sexual violence dating back to 2018, British Transport Police and the Metropolitan Police and the Crown Prosecution Service and magistrates all failed to protect the public, releasing Levy on bail four times in a series of failures. They let him walk free to stalk the transport network daily, claiming countless victims. While on bail, Levy carried out at least six sexual assaults on the tube, raped and suffocated a sex worker, leaving for her for dead, and killed two other women in a two-year rampage. Whew. After Levy was convicted today, the police watchdog announced two police officers were now under investigation for misconduct. This is him arriving at court, a free man. This is one of his victims. Another one of his victims. This is him on the tube. This is what he looks like without his glasses on. I mean, what a hideous beast. He has been convicted of carrying two murders, two rapes, a near fatal suffocation, and 13 sexual assaults. It took them 13 hours of deliberation, unanimous verdicts. Now there are calls for a public inquiry into the scandal as campaigners say the case makes a mockery of the police and the CPS promises to tackle violence against women. Look, they're not going to tackle black criminals like that, are they? Police believe there are many women who haven't come forward. The partially blind offender was first jailed for 3 years in 2021 for carrying out sex attacks on two women at a Notting Hill Carnival and Camden Street Party in 2018. But even in jail, he continued to target women, groping a prison officer. I mean, this is horrendous. Released on licence in October 23, when he started venturing out on the tube for prey, he regularly tied a jumper around his waist to hide his wandering hand as he grabbed the women around him. In May 24, he was recalled to prison following a rape allegation while the case was being investigated. He was released in August of the same year, after which he continued his campaign on the tube. His youngest victim was 18, his oldest 32. Levy has learning difficulties. I mean, the fatigue is real, isn't it? Levy has learning difficulties. And was supposed to be supervised by both probation and police visor, violence and sex offender register staff. There's a whole timeline here. There's a whole timeline here. I mean, I'll have to do an article on this. I mean, this is horrendous. He was arrested in November 24 for two sex attacks on the tube. One of the victims recorded him on her phone, capturing assaulting herself and another woman. However, a blundering British Transport officer delayed doing basic ID checks for weeks, opting to extend his bail. That transport officer needs to be sacked. British Transport Police Detective Superintendent Pete Fulton later admitted the officer just wasn't getting a grip on their workload. It was incompetent to be... of course it was incompetent. It wasn't because he was black, it was incompetent. He was found to have a Transport for London staff Oyster card, which had been reported missing by a bus driver. It allowed him to travel for free across the capital. British Transport Police handed the card back to him. They say they were unaware at the time it didn't belong to him. This only emboldened him. I mean, it goes on and on and on. And, you know, I mean, this article is thousands of words. You know, Britain's top police officer, Sir Mark Rowley, recently warned, "We've got extraordinarily prolific and dangerous offenders who there would not have been any doubt about even a couple of years ago. We would be have been remanding them in custody, but now they are being bailed and repeatedly bailed, then repeat offending, and that troubles us greatly. The system across the country is struggling." Well, it's struggling because of people like Simon Levy. I mean, there's got to be a public inquiry into this. But I think this tells you an awful lot about how blacks just get away with stuff. I mean, let's compare the case of Simon Levy with the case of people who shouted at police dogs at the protests that followed the Southport massacre. These people were immediately remanded in custody. They weren't granted bail. They were fast-tracked through the court system. And many of these had never had criminal records before. This man had an extensive criminal record of serious sexual assaults. He'd groped prison officers when he was inside. Yet he was allowed to continue with impunity. I'm going to do a full article on this for people who would like a sort of a 5,000 to 6,000 word breakdown. And we will you know, we'll go through it all, or I'll go through it all in the article. I'll expose it all. I'll go through everything that's been written about him, and we'll get that nailed down. But I think this absolutely, categorically proves something. And what it proves is that fundamentally, if you are black in Britain and you are committing serious crime, you will receive police bail. And I've talked about criminality. I've talked about criminality in my Substack articles. I've reported on criminal cases where serious offenders, people who have committed murder, have been given police bail. People who have murdered white boys have been given police bail. Yet people who have shouted things at police officers at protests are remanded in custody. This truly is the most shocking example of two-tier justice you could ever have. I'll write a full article on that, but I did want to talk about that tonight because it's breaking news. Now, there is one final issue that we're going to cover tonight before we do questions and answers. It's not going to be a long stream tonight because I'm going to go to bed. I'm going to have a nice early night because we've got a big day tomorrow. But we do have one last issue that I haven't discussed on stream, but I have written an article about. Now, this is obviously the issue of Jason Ardy, the former Cambridge professor, the youngest black professor at Cambridge. Now, I'm going to say this. This is going to be a more light-hearted take. Now, obviously, I've talked about my article about him. It's called The Cambridge's Black Time-Travelling Professor. You should check that out. It's free to read. It's had over 100,000 reads on Facebook, so people very much like it. And it's been republished, as I said, by Notice of News, Countercurrents, and the UNCE Review. So thank you to all the wonderful people who've noticed my work and are sharing it. Nothing I do goes behind the paywall. Remember that. I would rather it go on Facebook and be seen by 100,000 people than put it behind a paywall so half a dozen people pay me to read it. Spending that long writing an article that half a dozen people read, no real point, no real point. Doing what we're doing here, though, there is a point to it because people can see it and people support it and people want to support it. So thank you so much to those who do. Remember, it's all there for free if you want to go and have a look at it. I'm not going to go into it in depth again here, but I will say this, he told a lot of fantastical tales. He claimed to have run 30 marathons in 35 days, and the last of those 9 marathons were apparently run with a broken leg. So obviously, he is a liar. It's medically impossible. He claimed he didn't speak till he was 11 years old. Well, when you get to 11, due to synaptic pruning, it's very unlikely you could ever learn to speak. And now it says, in the latest article about him, he's been forced to quit his role at Cambridge, but Jason Ardy claimed he survived an unrecoverable car accident, locked-in system syndrome, and testicular cancer in newly serviced book proposal. Do you know what, though? Right, I can't blame Jason Ardy for this. And this is the key thing. A lot of the media are making fun of him. And look, we should make fun of him. He deserves to be laughed at, doesn't he? It is funny. But when it comes down to it, if you tell outrageous lies and people pay you tens or even hundreds of... I don't know, how much does a... I should have Googled this beforehand, shouldn't I? How much does a Cambridge professor make per year? Let's see what it says. Between £85,000 and £120,000 a year. So if you're going to make hundreds of thousands of pounds a year, why wouldn't you lie? And if you know everyone's going to believe you, why wouldn't you lie? I mean, his book deal with Simon & Schuster netted him £1.4 million. Simon & Schuster have allegedly given him a £1.4 million advance on the rights to his book. But can we really knock the guy? And I'm not saying this to be a defeatist or a contrarian. I mean this genuinely. And I'm asking all of you guys on the chat, in the chat, everyone in the chat, if you can interact for a second, if somebody offered you £120,000 a year and a £1.4 million book deal, and all you have to do to get it was invent crazy nonsensical lies that made your life sound extraordinary, would you do it? Would you do it? I mean, let's face it, if you're an average guy and a little angel lands on your shoulder and whispers in your ear, if you tell everyone you ran 9 marathons on a broken leg, we'll give you £120,000 a year. You're going to do it, aren't you? You're going to do it. And I'm not saying I feel sorry for him, because I don't feel sorry for him in the slightest. But what I am saying is fundamentally, you can't blame him. The system made him. He didn't make himself. People in the chat were saying, no, I don't believe it. Look, when it comes down to it, the system made this guy. The system made him. And what I mean by that is they offered him fantastical amounts of money for what? For talking crap. And he soon realised that the more crap he talked, the more they'd pay him. The more rubbish this man talked, the more money they gave him. Until eventually Simon and Schuster gave him £1.4 million, allegedly, in an advance payment for a book. So the more he got paid, the more he made up. He made up that he appeared on a television show that he couldn't have been on. He made up that he'd run 600 miles on a treadmill in 6 days. He made up he was a professional snooker player, a professional football player. He just wouldn't stop, would he? He wouldn't stop. And as I say, I don't have sympathy for him, but I absolutely understand why he did it. White liberals are one... Somebody in the chat said it. White liberals are absolute suckers. They wouldn't have challenged him because their morality, shall we say, their system of morality prevents them from saying to a black male, I don't think you're telling the truth. They can't say to a black male, you're lying. And because of that, they kept believing it. They called it an inspirational story. We'd call it BS. And they paid him for it. And I'm sorry, but if you set up a system that rewards that kind of behaviour, you're going to get more of that kind of behaviour. And the more he was paid for telling tall tales, the more he told the tall tales. It's a system of positive reinforcement. You know, when it comes down to it, I also am not annoyed in the slightest. Because I should imagine Simon and Schuster are a scumbag company. Oxford and Cambridge, I know this was at Cambridge University, but the Oxbridge universities are anti-white organisations. In a way, I actually see this as justice for them. I'm actually pleased they've wasted their money on him. Because if they hadn't wasted their money on him, they might have spent it on something that would be actually bad for white people. But they didn't. They spent it on this buffoon. And I like it. You know, it's just, and yeah, somebody in the chat said, it wouldn't have entered my mind to lie for financial gain. And maybe that's how white people are, you know, or maybe that's how nationalists are wired. And I certainly wouldn't lie for financial gain. But it is funny, isn't it? And like, well, then maybe, I don't know, like if Cambridge University came to me and said, could you please tell us about all the times you rode on the back of dragons and, flew to the moon to eat breakfast and mine cheese, and they were going to pay me $120,000 a year for it, maybe I could be tempted. I don't know. But what I'm basically saying here is I don't really blame him. I blame the anti-white institutions, the liberal idiots, and I think he just did what was best for him. And once he realised that spinning outrageous lies was going to net him major sums of money and, you know, create this persona for him of a very serious academic, he did it. And I'm pleased he harmed these white liberal organisations. But let's see his latest lies. So he had locked-in syndrome, testicular cancer. This is good. The book's called Great and Unfortunate Things. Yes. Great and Unfortunate Things. The Daily Mail is saying there are inconsistencies. There are inconsistencies, apparently. Professor Arde, 41, recounted being struck by a car as a teenager and spending several months in a coma, whereas in the memoir he described simply finishing school and taking his exams. The proposal for the book also said he had locked-in syndrome during the coma and witnessed doctors telling his parents that he would never recover and should be taken off life support as an act of mercy. I mean, it's kind of good, isn't it? It's kind of... I don't know. In some way, you've just got to laugh about these things because it's so... I mean, it is so ridiculous. The proposal said, as I will describe to readers in the book, these months afforded me another profoundly different way of perceiving the world. He added he awoke miraculously from the coma and spent a year relearning everything, how to walk and how to talk. I mean, it's incredible because he's learned to talk twice. He learned once to talk at 11, and then he relearned to talk after going into his coma. It's almost too good, isn't it? Then he had testicular cancer. Apparently also two brain tumours. I mean, it is just absolutely crazy. But the thing is, the establishment loved him. And they paid him handsomely for talking this crap. And as I said, this is the book, Great and Unfortunate Things. I mean, I wonder if it'll ever be published. It probably still will. A Pig's Head, A Litany of Medical Disasters, Superhuman Feats, Chapter by Chapter, How Oxbridge's Youngest Black Professor Has the Most Fantastical Life Story Ever Told. I mean, everyone's laughing at him now. But really, as I said, I don't really think it's a damning indictment of him. I think it's a damning indictment of the system. And let's just bear this in mind. Any serious academic system has got a duty to the people passing through that system. And it's got a duty to ensure that people like Jason Arde are weeded out. And it has a duty to do that for two reasons. The first is to make sure the right people get the job. And the second is to ensure that there is a constant upward cycle headed towards an ever-growing and unreachable pinnacle of excellence. It's like you're always aiming for the sky. But obviously with Jason Arde, that wasn't the case. He was someone who was just a notable liar who kept lying and lying and lying again and again and again and again and again. And when it comes down to it, what you can see here is a situation where the establishment is creating this. And in a way, the establishment is bringing about its own demise. Now, can you imagine Cambridge University with 100 Jason Ardes, 200, 400, 1,000? It would cease to exist. And this is the other reason why I laugh at these things, but I don't rage about them. Firstly, I understand why he did it, and I don't think you can blame him. I think, you know, everyone wants the best for their family. And if people are willing to believe your nonsense, you know, if you could put together a CV tomorrow with fantastical things on it and send it away to, you know, I don't know, HSBC Bank or Lloyds of London, and they were going to give you 200 grand a year to sit in an office and twiddle your thumbs and play around on Google all day because you'd made up a nonsensical life story, I think most people would do it. But the point is, systems should exist to stop that happening. So I don't blame Jason Ardy. I blame the admissions department. I blame the white liberals. I blame all of those who follow the woke agenda. I also, though, am not upset that he got paid that money, because he took that money from anti-white organisations and organisations that have now been humiliated. And I'm pleased they've been humiliated. And finally, in some ways, I'm pleased these anti-white organisations want to staff themselves with Jason Ardys, because I want them to collapse under their own terrible decision-making. So overall, I do find it a funny story. But I'm not outraged. I'm not a Daily Mail reader. I'm not there fuming. I'm not there sort of stewing in my juices every night getting angry about it. I actually believe that this is the outcome that the anti-white system deserves. And if you actually read books about bringing down systems, I actually forget the name of the guy. He's a really, really famous Jewish guy who wrote a book in the 60s about bringing down the system. Somebody in the chat will know. If somebody in the chat can help me out. What was the book? Famous Jewish American socialist 1960s revolutionary. What was the book called? It's come up with Abby Hoffman, but that's not... Saul Alinsky, Rules for Radicals. That's who I'm thinking about, Saul Alinsky. Saul Alinsky, in Rules for Radicals, said that one of the best weapons you could use against any system was actually ridicule. Saul Alinsky stated, once everyone's laughing at an authority figure, it becomes very hard for that authority figure to ever regain their position as a true authority figure. And that's why I quite like this, because this is absolutely reducing the system to a laughingstock. It's reducing anti-white authority to a laughingstock. Cambridge University is a laughingstock. The BBC is a laughingstock. Glasgow University, Roehampton, Liverpool John Moores University. They're all laughingstock organisations now because of this. And that's what we want to see. Because these supposed houses of academia are all pushing out anti-white theories. They're pushing out anti-family, pro-LGBT narratives. These organisations and bodies are very much seeding our demise on an academic level. So to reduce them to something which is to be laughed at, to be mocked, to be derided, is good. And I think we should often use some of the things in books like Saul Alinsky's Rules for Radicals as tools against the system. And that's why I just can't be mad about this. I laughed when I was writing the article about it. The sarcasm in the article is obviously heavy. And I found it amusing, because I want the public to laugh at these academics. And I want anti-white academia to be destroyed, to be discredited, to be defunded, and to be remembered not only as a vicious anti-white cog in the white genocide machine, but to be remembered as a laughingstock. And I think that's important. Anyway, let's do the super chats, because we've gone over an hour. Pleb Lord, he gave $1. Thank you so much. He said, any nationalists in Thetford area want to network? All legal, of course. Contact me at lawrence2003@hotmail.co.uk. No nutters, please. Sensible, intelligent people only. There you go. Thank you very much. Jack1996 gave $20. Thank you so much, my friend. He said, hey, Mark, thank you for everything from Australia. You absolutely bodied Bob in the first opening statement and got him to reveal exactly who he is instantly. He had absolutely nothing to refute. Well, thank you so much. Everyone seems to have really enjoyed the debate. And I remember when I wrote my opening statement, I sent it to Laura, and Laura just came back and said, there was everything she said everything that she had written down to sort of that she would have put in, it was there, and she said it was very well done. But I think the last question sort of destroyed him in opening statements to the point where I don't think he could recover. And the clips I've seen doing the rounds will certainly discredit him in the future. James Bruce 1488 gave $10. Thank you so much. Said, hey, Mark, just wanted to say you absolutely wiped the floor with Bob in the debate, and the way you made Bob confess into being a race-blind cuck within 5 minutes was chef's kiss. Brilliant. Well, thank you so much, my friend. I'm pleased you enjoy it. Greenius Saximus has been very generous tonight. Thank you so much, my friend. And if you ever want to write to me, you know where I am. I'm mark@fallofwesternman.com. He gave $10 and said, used to do screenwriting as a hobby, and I've been thinking about the idea of a gang and trafficking victim story. No one really cares until it happens to them. Film from a victim point of view might be a way to raise awareness. Look, I think that'd be really good. If you wrote it, we'd be happy to review it on book club. He gave another $5. Thank you tonight. Said, I was at the pub tonight and told a lady about this idea, and she told me she was a victim herself, and she told me she was keen to help. What's the chances of that? Idea 2 days ago and met a real source. Look, there's when you think about how many hundreds of thousands of white girls have been victims of these grooming gangs, you will bump into them. You know, you will bump into them. There are a lot of them out there, and there's a lot of ones who just won't have gone to the police. So, Greenius Saximus gave it $100. Thank you so much. He said, good luck tomorrow and at the march, folks. Well, thank you so much, my friend. It's very generous of you. And I said, if you ever want to write to me, feel free to do so. Hazelnut 3000 gave $15. Thank you so much. He said, thanks, Mark. Drive safely tomorrow. Thank you very much. Archie Debunker gave $5. Thank you so much. And said, Kevin Diana said that diaspora are foreign policy actors, e.g. India's diaspora lobby for India. Multinational corporations are causing jobs to telecommute out of the country. Elon's Tesla is part of the problem. No, of course. I completely agree, right? I completely agree. I think when you see people coming into your country, not only do they colonize it, but they usually lobby and vote in a way that makes your government treat their original home nation in a better way. I think that's how it is. I think that should always be should always bear that in mind. I mean, obviously, most famously, the Jewish diaspora do that with Israel. But I think the Indians do that. I think Pakistanis do that. And I think that's why Britain has forged greater links with India and Pakistan. I mean, just look how many of them are in the country. It makes sense for people who've come here to create those links, because those links create easier channels of migration further down the line, and most people who have come here wish to bring more of their own people here in the future. Archie Debunker gave another $5, thank you so much, and said, Greg Johnson's survey shows that among whites, only 2% of Democrats see that mass migration will make the Democratic Party permanent, but 68% of Republicans do. How can Democrats not see the permanent political power? I think it's because Democrats are race blind, or try to be, or I don't know. Or maybe they're lying. It's a difficult question to answer. I think the difference is Republicans see that as a problem. Democrats see that as a positive. So if the question is phrased to make that sound like it's problematic, Democrats would probably not admit to seeing it. Flemish Fighter gave $5, thank you so much, and said, people and individual populations who turn out, is there not a higher chance that people are voting more nationalistic, but the elderly white vote is just lagging behind? This is the issue. We are seeing an increasingly motivated minority, but that minority is still swamped by normies at the ballot box. And what you see is, the higher the turnout at the election, the more normies come out. And the more normies that come out, the more normal the election results are. So on a lower turnout election, what I'm saying is, people who vote for a more radical alternative are generally more radical people. And more radical people will obviously vote for a radical party, and they will be more motivated to go out. So if you vote for Reform or Restore or the Greens, you have an axe to grind, and you are likely to be more politically aware, more astute, and more motivated because you are trying to change the political system. That means if there is an election, you are more motivated to go out and vote. So what you actually see is a higher majority of Reform, Restore and Green Party voters voting in low turnout elections, skewing the results. However, if you're a normie who is largely unaware of problems or keeps themselves knowingly in the dark, or is actually quite happy with the way things are rumbling on because they've got a decent job, they live a decent life, they're comfy, they've got plenty of goy slop takeaway, and they like watching the footy, you probably aren't that motivated to go out and vote. And if it rains, you probably stay at home. However, when there is a big election and everyone's talking about it, and you do go out, you then go and vote for a mainstream party. That's why in lower turnout elections, that highly motivated, radicalised minority make a bigger difference per capita than they do in a higher turnout election. So what you will see is in these smaller elections, Reform and Restore and the Green Party will do disproportionately well. At a general election, when the turnout rises to nearly 60% or above, you will see a swing back to normie politics. You don't want a high turnout. And if you remember correctly, and I do, during the Brexit vote, people on the left openly said, we need it to be a nice day. Because normal people who are happy with the status quo would be more likely to vote Remain. But they are less motivated to go out and vote overall because they're voting for the existing status quo. The more radical people who are more likely to vote for Brexit have an axe to grind and will vote rain or shine. And when there was floods in London on polling day, the left had their head in their hands because they knew that many people, including ethnic minorities, would be less who were likely to vote Remain, would be less likely to go out and vote. And obviously Brexit won. And it's something that's been historically cited as important. For example, if there was a nationalist on the ballot paper, I would go out and vote even if hailstones the size of, you know, golf balls were coming down on my head. Because I think it's important to go out and vote. And I'd brave it. I'd go out and do it. Wouldn't bother me. I would go out and vote. I would do everything I could to get that nationalist elected. But if golf balls were coming down, your floating voter, your sort of loosely attached Labour voter, your normie who either votes Tory or Labour, depending on, you know, the way the wind's blowing, they don't go out. So a low turnout election favours people like us. And that's why you see nationalists do disproportionately well at council elections. And the problem is, what we need, when you see these high turnout elections, it confuses people. Because nationalists have this sort of misunderstanding of the system, that the people who aren't voting because there isn't a radical enough alternative out there. That's not how it works, unfortunately. Appalachia and Victor gave $5. Thank you so much. He said, did you know the Appalachian Mountains are the same chain which runs through the north of England and Scotland? Funny how our people left the hills of the UK for the hills of the East Coast. 88. I didn't know that. But thank you so much. Horatio Hornblow gave $5. Thank you so much. Said, I watched your coverage on Louis Theroux's The Settlers documentary after watching it myself. That Daniela Weiss is pretty insidious. Would you consider doing more Louis Theroux videos? I have done. So I did the breakdown on Louis Theroux Inside the Manosphere, and that was an hour and a half documentary. And I did the whole thing. I think my coverage was about 2.5 to 3 hours. Now, here's the interesting thing. I did it live on Rumble and Odyssey. And both, and Netflix, who owned the documentary, went after me. And even though it was fair use, because I watched the documentary and covered it in full and interjected multiple times, the documentary, it was 2 hours, 47 minutes and 7 seconds was my review. And it was claimed by Netflix, and Netflix had it pulled down as a spurious copyright claim. So you can't see it anymore. But if you want to see it, I believe it's still on my BitChute, which you can only access via a VPN if you're living in the UK. But I have done others, so go and enjoy that. It's nearly 3 hours. Greenius Saximus gave another $5. Thank you so much. And said, while it's bad as it seems, I'll make for a bloody good redemption arc for the history books. Well, look, as I said, I'm never black-pilled because I know that a small number of motivated people are always the ones to change history and write the future. Appalachia and Victor gave $10. Thank you so much. Said, our greatest export has been our people. There are more ethnic Britons who are white nationalists abroad than white conservative voters in the UK. We are with you. P.S. Come to Appalachia. My friend, if I could come and visit you, I absolutely would. But I can't because I'm banned from travelling to America. Anyway, that is the end of the Super Chats. But people have been very generous tonight, so I will take a limited number of free questions. If anyone wants to ask a free question, I'll answer them. So thank you for such generosity. And because people were very generous, we had very generous donations on Wednesday, very generous donations tonight. If anyone would like to ask a free question, I'll answer them. You know, I'm not going to sit here and bat them away. People have been very, very kind. So if anyone wants to ask a free question, they can. If there aren't any, I'll go to bed. Is circumcision satanic, says Appalachia and Victor. You know I hate talking about that. I ended up talking about that with David Duke on Thursday. I think, look, there are limited, genuine medical needs for circumcision. Obviously, circumcision from a medical perspective for people who need it should be made available. And if adult males wish to do that and have it done to themselves, it's up to them. However, from a moral point of view, it is completely immoral to force a serious and irreversible body modification on a child that can't consent. As such, if it is a non-medical, religious body modification, it should be banned. And as I pointed out in the David Duke show, it is banned to do that to females. So why not males? Why don't young males have the same protection? And obviously, you know, if people wish to do it as adults, consenting adults, who am I to stop people doing it? But not for babies. And I think if we banned it, as nearly 100% of Muslims do it, and obviously all Jews do it, I think it would change the ethnic composition of Britain pretty quickly. So I think that's a pretty based take. Apparently, Simon Tomlin apparently is attacking me again. Oh, God. That guy's a nut. Just, you know, take one look at him. He's a Walter Mitty. He makes things up and he comes out with nutty stuff. He's not worth listening to. Pleb Lordy gave $1, thank you so much, and said, is it sensible to identify strengths, qualities in your enemies rather than seeing as cardboard cut-out villains? Look, if you don't identify the strengths and qualities of your enemies, and if you belittle your enemies, that is a major weakness. I'll say this. There's an old tale about the First World War. And it's that the British leadership painted the Germans as demons. As demons to be feared. And told the troops that if you come across these demonic Germans, you must fight them to the death because they are, you know, demonic warriors that will do unthinkable things to you. The Germans, however, belittled the British and mocked them as a nation of shopkeepers. The Germans didn't fear the British, but the British had a healthy fear of the Germans. And I think you know where I'm going here with this. The Germans probably were shocked when they came up against such fierce resistance from the nation of shopkeepers. But the Brits were ready to fight tooth and nail against these people that had been told were essentially demonic warriors. Now, obviously, there's a certain mindset there, and I do think you should analyse your enemies. And if your enemy has a certain strength, you should look at that and try to analyse how to overcome it, avoid it, or find a corresponding weakness that you can exploit. Sean Not Seen said, Mark, I think you did great job with Bob with your debate, but he did ask a question you didn't quite answer. He said, would you rather black Christians take over Britain or the white population be converted to Islam? I thought I did answer that. I mean, obviously, I don't want Britain to become Islamic. But if you said to me, would I rather white Britons take on Islam or be completely obliterated, I'd obviously have to say I would rather us take on another religion and continue to exist, hopefully with the view of throwing that off in the future, because we still exist. Once we cease to exist, we can't take on any religion because we're not there anymore. And I think what Bob was saying is, would you rather, you know, black Christians completely take over Britain, or white Britons remain, but they take on Islam? Well, obviously, neither of those things are good, but you would have to always go with white Britons surviving. Because once we don't survive, all options are off the table because we're gone. It's a difficult question, because obviously we don't want any Islam in Europe. It was probably one of the better questions, but I did think I answered that, but I hope I've answered it now. Need a Simon Sideways stream with Mark again? I'd happily do that. Napoleon said we were a nation of shopkeepers. There you go. I've got it the wrong way round, so my apologies there. I'm sure the Germans though did have some sort of, you know, did they called us something? Let me just Google this. How did the Germans refer to Britons in World War One? Was it a nation of shopkeepers? No, you're definitely right. That was Napoleon. So I am incorrect there. Were the German propaganda posters, German anti-British World War One propaganda poster, was it the Germans in World War One who characterised the Britons as like small people wearing sort of bowler hats? I am sure that someone at some point basically, you know, made Britons look small and inconsequential to make their people believe that we were small, inconsequential people, which obviously backfired greatly. But if it was Napoleon and not World War One, then unfortunately I've got it incorrect. So thank you for the update. Greeny Asaximus gave another $5. Thank you so much. I've had a real devil's advocate thought about Tiny Moustache Man's books. It's 100 years old and had the thought, what's the chances it's been edited and not 100% his words? I still think you can find exact translations of his works. So I don't think it has. I think it's... I think it is accurate. But you have to just check which translation you've got. And also, there are original copies out in the wild in German that could be translated. It's not sort of like a biblical text that, you know, has been passed down, edited, and there's certain chunks, sort of like the Book of Enoch, that have been completely removed. Anyway, that's the end of the paid questions and the free questions. It's been nearly an hour and a half. I hope we've had a serious chat and some amusing moments. I might be off now to grow some dreadlocks and tell everyone that I've run 30 miles in 35 days. I'm hoping that Oxford accept my application and I'm going to be the first white ethno-nationalist. No, of course that wouldn't be because I'm white. No, I'm going to go and get an early night and I'm going to look forward to Tamworth. If you can be in Tamworth tomorrow, 1 p.m, St. Editha's Square, join us. Would be great to see you. And it would be lovely to shake all your hands. Hope you're there. There's going to be a couple of little surprises if you do turn up. I think it's going to be a good day. Anyway, thank you so much to everyone who donated so very generously. I'm pleased we had such generosity because we've done another free Q&A, which I very much enjoy doing. I hope it's been a good stream. I'll see you hopefully tomorrow, and if not on Sunday. Thank you to all those who donated and all those who tuned in. Have a lovely weekend. Hopefully see you tomorrow. Love you all. God bless.